Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the Rohingya refugee crisis. With me to discuss the displacement of Muslim Rohingyas from Myanmar is Meenakshi Ganguly. Meenakshi is the South Asia Director at Human Rights Watch. Since joining the organization in 2004, she has worked on a broad range of issues in the region, including police reform, sexual violence, and armed conflict. Previously, Meenakshi was the South Asia correspondent for Time magazine. Meenakshi is joining me from Mumbai, India, so any apologies for the quality of our recording. Meenakshi, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
Meenakshi, I'd like if we could to sort of begin with a scene setter about the nature of the problem with the Rohingya. I imagine many people have seen a little bit of news about the Rohingya on television, maybe in their Twitter feed or what have you. Could you sort of lay out for us who the Rohingya are and why they're in the news?
The Rohingya are people who live in Rakhine State in Myanmar. They are a minority population, both because of their ethnicity and because of their faith. So they are predominantly Muslim, and they are ethnically more South Asian than Burman. So their features are more South Asian. For a long time, it goes back, as many things do in the subcontinent, to the British time, the Myanmar people of Myanmar, or Burma as we used to call it then, believed that the Rohingya do not belong in Myanmar. They are settlers. They were brought in and they should therefore no longer live in Myanmar. Myanmar authorities do not consider them to be citizens, and they are really very, very shabbily treated. And this has been going on for decades.
Can I ask you just a question right there, Meenakshi? Because I have heard it spoken of that the Burmese regard the Rohingya as outsiders. Mm-hmm. But my understanding also is that the migration of the Rohingya into what is now modern-day Myanmar took place centuries ago, back in the 1400s. Is that correct?
Yes, this is the subcontinent where a lot of people moved around. So for Burma to now, the present day boundaries, of course, didn't exist because at that point it was British colonial India. You know, a number of, Pakistan was created later, Bangladesh even later. So these are borders that have created and people moved around. So that is why it is such a problem for that the Myanmar authorities even today want to suggest that these are not Burmese nationals, or they do not belong in Myanmar, and they should be sent back to where they came from. A phrase, of course, that many leaders now seem to be promoting. But at that point, for all these decades, the Burmese have said it for a long time about the Rohingya.
So my understanding is when Myanmar gained its independence back in 1948, mm-hmm. right from the start, the government refused to recognize the Rohingya as one of the country's, I think it's 135 official ethnic groups.
That's right. They didn't, but initially they were allowed to vote. So that some of their rights have been whittled away over the decades. So, you know, initially they were allowed to vote, then their voting rights were taken away. You know, I have met Rohingya in Myanmar who have run for office and have voted in elections. But then as these sort of new citizenship laws were brought in, the Rohingya community was increasingly excluded. And that was just the start of the problem, because what happened was when they began to face this kind of discrimination, obviously there were some incidents of protest, and every incident of protest was treated as an act of great security threat, and the crackdown was enormous. This again went on for some time, and some of your listeners will probably remember even back in 2015 or 2012 these stories of these boatloads of Rohingya that were found bobbing around in the Bay of Bengal trying to make their way to various parts of the world. So this has been a problem for some time. The reason why it's shocking about what happened in 2017 is because by then Aung San Suu Kyi had been elected.
Okay, now Aung San Suu Kyi is the Myanmar leader who won the Nobel Peace Prize. She was under house arrest for a number of years by the military government in Myanmar, correct?
That's right. That's why it was so. She was, you know, for a long time, Aung San Suu Kyi was the hero of the human rights movement. She was this woman who had come into Myanmar. She had lived in house arrest. She had refused to bow to the military junta and had defied them. And eventually had, you know, her movement for democracy had prevailed to hold these elections. elections. And, you know, the magic of those elections with all these Burmese people outside, including, frankly, the Rohingya, they too celebrated her return, her sort of ability to lead the government. She herself cannot because of a Myanmar law, which means where if you have a foreign national whose relative, you cannot hold office. And of course, Aung San Suu Kyi was married to a UK national and has two British sons. But even so, she's de facto the head of the NLD and the government. But anyway, because of this great hope, when we imagined that things would improve for the Rohingya and for all the other ethnic minorities in Myanmar, what instead happened in August of 2017 was that there was an attack on some police posts by an armed group. 11 security personnel were killed. But in retaliation, the Myanmar military launched an operation of unprecedented abuse. I work on human rights in South Asia, which is a difficult part of the world, but the testimony that we were hearing at that time was absolutely shocking. So this was, in 2017, August of 2017, so not so long back.
Can you help me understand this, Meenakshi? Because when I look at Myanmar, it is a country, as I noted, that has more than 100 official ethnic groups, and it has local armed insurrections in various parts of the country. But it seems that the hostility of the central government is really aimed against the Rohingya. Do we know why that's the case? Why the Rohingya in particular have been an object of longstanding oppression by the Myanmar government? I mean, I'll note, my understanding is since 2005, the government has limited how many children the Rohingya can have. There's been a long history of deportation and forced population transfers. Can you help us understand sort of why this seems to be qualitatively different from other kinds of ethnic and religious repression in Myanmar?
It's hard to say, but or accept that there could be such extreme bigotry attached to a certain population group. When we look at what happens even on social media and the way that people speak of the Rohingya, there is the sense that the Rohingya are outsiders, the Rohingya are dirty, they are not to be trusted. All of these sort of very bigoted, and we've seen this play out in history so many times before, a sort of a level of hate towards a community that they don't necessarily even know. It's quite entrenched. And the Rohingya will speak of it as well, because the Rohingya themselves will always say that they're Burmese. They speak the language, they have the cultural habits. I think it makes them really sad when we speak with the refugees. They often speak of how they felt, it's almost like, being cast aside by your family, that they are not liked. Forget the state and forget the military and all of that. They often say that even ordinary Burmese people will not like the Rohingya, and they feel discriminated against almost routinely.
Now, as you've noted, Meenakshi, that the oppression of Rohingya took a turn in 2017 following this attack on police outposts. There was an intense military crackdown that led to a large number of refugees, many of whom went across the border to Bangladesh. Can you give us a sense of sort of the scale of the refugee problem? I hear a lot about Cox's Bazar, but perhaps you can fill in some of the details for us.
I still remember when I first received this call, which said that a group of Rohingya have arrived in Bangladesh. And, the Bangladesh authorities actually already host a number of Rohingya from previous attacks upon them and have not been very welcoming of refugees. So initially, our concern was really how will the Bangladesh authorities respond? And we were starting to make phone calls to make sure that the refugees are going to be safe. And then, so one of my colleagues was there and he said, you cannot imagine the numbers of people that are streaming across. It was in the thousands. People were just running with what they could have grabbed from their homes. And behind them, across the border, people could see the villages burning because the Myanmar military had started to burn villages. So it was unprecedented. And even if Bangladesh wanted to stop them, they couldn't have because the numbers were so large. But to their credit, Bangladesh actually was very generous. They tried as much as possible to try and handle this circumstance. But in those initial weeks, Jim, it was people were sitting on the streets, desperate people, traumatized. A number of them had been raped. A number of people had seen their children being killed in front of them or their loved ones being killed in front of them. Their entire homes lost was deeply traumatized. Thousands and thousands of people just lining the streets. streets. Then gradually, you know, it began to be rebuilt. But so, you know, by the time in the end, like over 640,000 people, 740,000 people had come in by the end of 2017. But the abuses continued and people still come. Rohingya from Myanmar still come if they can. They cross the border and come across.
And I should note that the United Nations has called what took place in the Rakhine State in Myanmar against the Rohingya as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. And my understanding is that there are somewhere north of 1 million Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. Is that correct? Yes.
Right now, Bangladesh is hosting more than 1 million Rohingya refugees, some that were already there, and of course, the nearly 800,000 that have since arrived since August 2017. It's a large number of people. Humanitarians have managed to try and build some shelters, so it's a little more organized now, but these are really makeshift shelters. This is, you know, really crowded place. And quite often, I mean, we've been really worried, as have all the aid workers and the Bangladesh authorities themselves, about any risk of what happens if there is a spread of COVID-19 in these areas, because these are really crowded shelters and settlements without much scope for social distancing. You know, they're flimsy shelters.
Let me ask you about that, Meenakshi, because my understanding is one of the refugee camps outside of Cox's Bazar, which is a Bangladeshi city, I guess, in the eastern part of the country near the border with Myanmar, that refugee camp is the largest one in the world. It has more than 600,000 people. And I've heard early reports that COVID has shown up in the camp, but mm-hmm. the numbers are really low. But I guess the first thing I have to ask is, can anyone believe these numbers, given that I would imagine medical facilities in the refugee camp are pretty minimal, if they exist at all?
Yes, of course. I mean, testing is low in Bangladesh altogether, and certainly much lower in the camps. As of now, however, there haven't been, last I heard, there'd been one death and about 30 positive cases. That is people who are showing up with symptoms. But here is where I do want to start talking about how Bangladesh is handling the refugees. So while I mentioned that in 2017, Bangladesh had been kind and had welcomed them, that welcome is beginning to wear thin. And therefore, one of the things that is happening in these refugee camps is that there is no internet. Now, without internet, what happens is that there is no way that in such a large refugee population, people are able to send out information, to communicate with people, to try and explain what the symptoms are, what the precautions are. And therefore, one of the things that we've heard quite strongly is that the Rohingya fear that if they go to the camp to get their symptoms tested, then they might be taken away and they might even be killed. I mean, the rumors are huge because there is no access to informed messaging, because there is no communication. And therefore, you're right. What could be happening is that a lot of people may not even have gone to report their symptoms because they fear that they'll be taken away and will be killed. It's as basic as that right now, the danger that exists in this area.
It's easy, Meenakshi, to understand the resentment that may be bubbling up in Bangladesh over flux of refugees from Myanmar. But I'm curious, as we look at the refugee camps that exist in Bangladesh, how are they supported? How are they funded? Is this supported by the Bangladeshi government? Is it supported by international private aid agencies, international organizations? How do you make a refugee camp work?
Well, you know, of course, it's the humanitarian agency, the international humanitarian agencies that lead the effort. So it's UNHCR, the Refugees Commission. There's IOM. There's UNICEF. There's a whole bunch of UN bodies that are working there. There are also other charities that are working there. There's MSF that runs hospitals, which are the key areas that's
Doctors Without Borders, the French acronym.
Yes, that's right. Yes. So there is also Bangladeshi NGOs and groups that are working there. The administration is done by Bangladesh authorities. So each camp is managed by a camp leader who's a Bangladeshi official. And the entire refugee effort is also led by a Bangladesh official. It is supported to a large part by humanitarian assistance. And that also is becoming a bit of a challenge because, of course, there is quite a bit of gap. And as we enter into the sort of some of the economic challenges that will come about post-COVID, there are concerns that the money that is needed to support the refugee community may also also reduce, which will be another thing to fear, because these are nearly a million people. There is also 55% of them are children who right now do not have access to proper education. These people need to be supported in a way where they have a future that they can look to. And right now, they don't.
Now, has there been any progress, Meenakshi, when looking at relations between the refugees and the government back in Myanmar? Has there been any change under Aung San Suu Kyi about allowing refugees to return? Or are we facing a situation in which, in essence, the policy of the Burmese government is to continue to encourage people to leave?
Well, there is what they say and what they do, isn't there, Jim? What they say will be that, of course, we want to verify these people, we want to issue verification cards, and then they can return once they've been verified. The first thing that the Rohingya will say is, what does that verification card entail? What kind of information are you gathering from us, and how will we be treated when we go back? Now, they have some sense of how they might be treated, because in Myanmar, in Rakhine Strait, there are an estimated 500,000 Rohingya people who are pretty much living in conditions of open-air detention. They have been there since the violence that I mentioned in 2012. There are about 125,000 Rohingya and about 3,000 Kanan Muslims who are in these camps right now, which are literally open-air prisons. So what happens is that when the Rohingya in Bangladesh are discussing their return, what they don't want happening is to be ending up in these kind of prison conditions. It hasn't helped that we've seen pictures of what the Myanmar authorities describe to be camps that returning Rohingya will be held in before they return to their villages, which look pretty much like detention camps. They're high with barbed wire and so on. So that's the first thing. The second is that Bangladesh has said rightly that they will not force the Rohingya to return, which means that the conditions have to be such that the Rohingya voluntarily return. Now, to do that, Myanmar has to make a certain set of commitments, which will not just be to make sure that it's dignified and safe for people to go back to their homes, but that there will be some sort of justice, that there will be a promise of non-recurrence, you know, that people will be able to go back to the properties that they left behind. Now, none of those things are being talked about. So, as I said, what they say and what they do, none of these things have been done. So there is no way that the Rohingya are going to feel at all confident about returning. The entire conversation around repatriation is being brokered by China. Now, Bangladesh had initially trusted China to make sure that Myanmar will keep its commitments on protecting the Rohingya when they choose to return, but that has just simply not happened. So Bangladesh is also finding itself a bit friendless right now, because it is hosting a large number of people, and it's increasingly finding it difficult. It is saying that, why is it that only Bangladesh has to bear responsibility for this? And they feel that the international community has not pressed Myanmar enough to do the right thing here, which means a lot of things, between holding people accountable for the violence that occurred, creating the conditions, giving UNHCR access to make sure that these people are safe. None of those things are happening.
Well, what about the role of ASEAN? Myanmar is a member of ASEAN. Has ASEAN taken any position on this?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask, Jim, because, you know, recently the Rohingya, a few hundred of them, set out on boats yet again in the Bay of Bengal. And they were headed to Malaysia. And a large number of them were actually women and girls. Girls whose marriage had been arranged with Rohingya men in Malaysia, and women and their children who were trying to join their husbands who were already in Malaysia. So these boats set out, and Malaysia, that had initially been kind to the Rohingya, said that they were not going to let them land. They pushed the boats back. These boats bobbed around. We don't even know how many lives were lost, because eventually some were rescued by Bangladesh. One was finally rescued by Malaysia. Some showed up on the Indonesian coast. And the Malaysian authorities have since said, oh, well, these refugees need to go back to Bangladesh, because they came from the Bangladesh refugee camps. And Bangladesh quite rightly is saying, well, that's not fair, because, you know, why is it, again, their argument that why is it that the Rohingya responsibility is only on us? ASEAN has to do the right thing, not only in supporting the refugees, supporting Bangladesh in this crisis, but putting much more pressure on Myanmar to do the right thing.
What about the attitudes of the Indian government? Has India taken any role here, or see a role for itself, given particularly Delhi's sense of its importance as a major power in South Asia, with influence extending across what we used to call Indochina?
Jim, I would love to have seen India play a positive role. Instead, we have seen India play a negative role. So India right now is governed by a Hindu nationalist government, which also has some of its leaders have expressed fairly bigoted views about Muslims. So what happened was that when the 40,000 or so Rohingya refugees showed up in India, the political discourse was that we could send them back. Now, send them back where? To Bangladesh? To Myanmar? Where? I mean, you know, it violates all sorts of international law. So instead of being a friend to Bangladesh, supporting Bangladesh in taking care of the refugees, in exerting what power it had to persuade Myanmar to do the right thing, we instead found that India was also becoming part of the problem and being unsympathetic to the Rohingya refugees.
What about Western powers, Meenakshi? I mean, typically the United States historically has played a role in promoting human rights. European Union, typically by its side, have either or both played a positive role in trying to address what's happening to the Rohingya?
You know, the thing is that initially, like us human rights workers who had so greatly admired Aung San Suu Kyi, so too had Western governments who had after all spoken for her on in defense of her for years, for the entire time that she was held in under house arrest in Myanmar. So it took them a while to even understand that Aung San Suu Kyi was not going to do the right thing or was not going to challenge her military to do the right thing in this case. So the response, unfortunately, was a bit slow. To a large part, the UK posed the pen on Myanmar because of Aung San Suu Kyi's personal connections with the UK. She lived there for a long time and has family there. And we've been speaking with them. And right now, I think many even in the British Foreign Office have acknowledged that there is a problem. The US also has now acknowledged there is a problem. There have been some sanctions announced against the military chief and other individuals in Myanmar. But it needs more. It needs more because this is one of the most blatant acts of bigotry and ethnic cleansing that has happened in recent times. And if the world doesn't stand up on the right side now, then we will see this playing out in other places as well. So at a moment when the world, you know, after George Floyd, where we are all talking about you know, security forces who use excessive force, the bigotry in amongst police, the fact that communities feel discriminated against. These are conversations around the world. Now, when we're having those conversations, here is an example of what happens when these things are not sorted. 1 million people are refugees in another country. Another 500,000 that's been left behind in Myanmar is living under extremely dire conditions. So if we want to stand for rights, I feel that the Rohingya are a test case for how the world responds and how we do right by people and make sure that they can go home. Every Rohingya I speak to only says this, I just want to go back home.
I'll note on this point, Meenakshi, that UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres a couple of years ago said that he had no doubt that the Rohingya people have always been one of, if not the most discriminated people in the world. So, I mean, this has been a longstanding problem. Now, I was probably remiss in not asking this question, so let me ask it now, even if it's a bit late. As you look at Aung San Suu Kyi, again, winner of a Nobel Peace Prize, a lot of people had great hopes about her commitment to human rights, and you see that she's not acting proactively in terms of protecting Rohingya in Myanmar. How do we explain this? Why is it that she hasn't taken, in your view, the steps needed to protect a clearly discriminated against population?
You know, I rack my brains on it and I cannot come up with an answer. People tell me that she is no different from anybody else. After all, you know, she comes from a military family. Her connections to the military are strong. But in an odd way, while the Rohingya faced discrimination and abuses when Myanmar was governed by the military, the worst thing happened while she was in office. And we've yet for her to even utter the word Rohingya. She just didn't even utter the word, which is how the Rohingya people self-identify. So it really is difficult. But there is more. You know, I mean, we have often felt that, you know, the Rohingya crisis should be referred to the ICC, but that needs Security Council. And of course, China would possibly block that. Or
ICC being the International Criminal Court.
That's right. So instead, however, the Gambia filed a case in the International Court of Justice saying that Myanmar's treatment of the Rohingya had violated the Genocide Convention. And What was interesting is that when the hearing was going on at the International Court of Justice at The Hague, Aung San Suu Kyi came in to speak as foreign minister to literally seek that the court drop the genocide case against her country. And in that, she was therefore defending the Burmese military, the Myanmar military, the same military that had once imprisoned her. She had ended up now defending them. So one can say that, you know, when you're in government, you have to sort of defend your country in international platforms. But I think that almost all human rights activists, many members of the international community, were a bit surprised to see her there, present in that courtroom, standing up and trying to say that what had happened to the Rohingya had not really happened, in the face of the fact that a million of them are right now living in squalor in Bangladesh.
What do you make of arguments or defenses of Aung San Suu Kyi's behavior that run along the lines of she's in a very difficult position, she's trying to institutionalize democracy in Myanmar, and she faces a lot of reactionary pull from the military, and the Rohingya is one issue that would likely set back that larger project, and so her action should be understood in that context?
Initially, I think that was often said. I mean, when we used to go and meet with governments and speak for the Rohingya, you know, when we would talk about this, that's what they would say. The truth is that when she was elected with such a massive mandate. People were out on the streets. That level of support and that kind of mandate, when it is given to a leader, that leader becomes incredibly powerful. And then it is the time for that leader to use that power to make a stamp of how that leader is going to be different. How her vision of Myanmar was one that was going to be rights respecting, one that was going to end discrimination, one that was going to be about equality. And those were the principles that had won her the Nobel Prize, after all. That was what people had believed when they'd given her that prize. So therefore, and numerous other prizes for that matter. And therefore, even if there was a calculus, this was not the issue on which that calculus should have been played out. Not when women had been raped. Not when they had seen their children bludgeoned to death in front of them. Not when there were children that were flung into burning houses. That is not when you try and negotiate a democratic space. That is the test of democracy. And democratic leaders stands firm and speaks for people who have been so terribly oppressed.
And actually, to go back to the lawsuit at the International Court of Justice, it is a lawsuit that was triggered when Gambia filed against Myanmar on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. In January of this year, the ICJ ruled that Myanmar must take immediate emergency measures to protect the remaining Rohingya. Has that ruling had any effect?
I'm afraid we have not seen any change in the way that the Burmese authorities are behaving with the Rohingya that are still in Myanmar. And certainly we have not seen any change in attitude about refugees who are still in Bangladesh. So when the ICJ hearing was going on, it was a brief moment when Bangladesh actually lifted internet restrictions. And so people, thousands in the camps, actually sat there and looked at the proceedings and had believed that this was going to be a turning point, that, you know, Myanmar had been rebuked and they would be forced to change. And we didn't really see that kind of impact. We haven't seen any kind of contrition from the Myanmar authorities as yet. And certainly no effort to then now reassure the Rohingya that they are going to get their citizenship rights in the way that they deserve.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Meenakshi Ganguly, South Asia Director for Human Rights Watch. Meenakshi, let me say thank you for coming on the show, but also thank you for all your efforts and the efforts of Human Rights Watch to put a spotlight on what is happening with the Rohingya.
Thank you so much.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or the guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe was also our recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.